story you are about to hear may contain detailed descriptions of intense violence. It will certainly be worse than fiction.
Hello, my name is Les. Thank you for joining me as we take a look at a true tale of unimaginable horror. Before we get into this story, I have to give you a full disclaimer. This is a revised and re-recorded and much more polished version of Episode 1. The original went live on November 4th, 2019, and though the response to the podcast as a whole has been absolutely phenomenal, I don't think it was a good representation of where the podcast stands just 9 episodes later. I've learned a lot, gotten some high-quality equipment and software, and have improved in pretty much every aspect. In the near future, I will also be redoing episodes 2 and 3 at the very least, and possibly even 4. I appreciate you for giving me a few minutes of your time to share something I've worked very hard at making. On with the show. In this story, we'll hear the tale of James Urban Rupert, a 41-year-old man living with his mother after a lifetime of failure at being a contributing member of society. A man who left a legacy of horror that should never be forgotten. You see, James was very good at one particular thing, and it would leave a stain on his family and in a house that sits on the 600 block of Minor Avenue in Hamilton, Ohio. Stains that are still visible to this day. This story is very local to me. In fact, I live 6 or so blocks away from where it took place. I've walked, driven, and rode by this house many, many times in the 22 plus years I've lived in this town. I remember when I moved here from my small hometown in southeast Kentucky, one of the first people I became friends with here asked me if I had ever heard of the Rupert House. Of course, being from about 200 miles or a 3.5-hour drive away, and having not even been born at the time it occurred, I hadn't heard of this case. However, since our family came to Hamilton, Ohio, we've spent most of our time living within a 15-minute walk from the house where James Rupert committed the ultimate act of betrayal upon his own family. I'm kind of a black sheep among most of the circle of friends I grew up with, being the only one who is deeply interested in true crime stories, conspiracy theory, terrible environmental accidents, horrific man-made disasters, and so on. I've been fascinated with this stuff since I was a single-digit age. I remember watching Unsolved Mysteries when I was very young and being just as glued to the TV as I would with a good cartoon. I don't fully understand my utter fascination with these subjects, but there it is. I have to be perfectly honest with you here. There is very little audio or video footage surrounding this case, and other source material is scarce at best. I've done everything I can to write a story that is hopefully interesting, accurate, and doesn't toy around with rabbit holes too much, though I will inject a bit of my own opinions in certain areas. For the most part, though, it'll only be small quips. So without further ado, let's get into the topic of the first episode of Worse Than Fiction. I hope you enjoy, if that's the right word for it. Imagine this with me for a few moments. It's Easter Sunday, a Christian holiday with a long tradition of families getting together, sharing a feast, kids hunting Easter eggs, adults catching up with each other. You're in the kitchen preparing sandwiches for your 8 grandchildren, chatting with your daughter-in-law while your oldest son is sitting at the table reading the newspaper, having a cup of coffee and a smoke. It's late afternoon and your youngest son, who had moved back in with you at 40 years old, finally emerges from his bedroom after sleeping off a late night of hard drinking. He and his brother strike up a short conversation on the stock market, and at some point the older brother asks how the younger brother's Volkswagen is doing. The younger brother doesn't respond to the question, instead stating that he's going to the target range for some shooting practice. So he goes upstairs to get his guns and ammo. When he comes back down, he sets his rifle up against the refrigerator, pulls a .22 caliber pistol, and opens fire. March 29th, 1934. A baby boy is born to mother Charity Rupert and father Leonard Rupert Sr. This is the second-born child of this young, blossoming family. They were already parents of a boy, Leonard Jr., who was a toddler at the time of James Urban Rupert's arrival. Ultrasound technology had yet to be realized at this point in history, coming to fruition about 10 years after James was born, so the Ruperts, as all expecting parents before them, didn't know whether their baby would be male or female. Charity desperately hoped to have a girl, but was sorely disappointed when the baby that had been born turned out to be male. She was crushed and never kept this fact from James as he was growing up. With every mistake he made, he was humiliated and shamed for simply being who he was. James had to deal with this for much of his life, the feeling that he was never wanted. The disappointment was exacerbated by the fact that this was a young man that never excelled in anything he attempted, and Charity and Leonard Sr. made sure he understood his place within the family. He had failed them by simply being born. It's heartbreaking when you think about it. A young child who barely knows how to tie his shoes has to deal with parents who remind him all too often that he was a mistake, that he should have never existed. It's an understatement to say that James didn't really know what being a loved member of the family felt like growing up. Leonard Sr. was an emotionless father, and it shouldn't be a shocking revelation to those of us who grew up hearing the stories of kids who had a tyrannical father back in the middle decades of the 20th century. In those days, Dad was the be-all, end-all of the family. This kind of fatherhood was all too common in those days, whether anyone liked it or not. Interestingly, this is a familiar thread among some of the worst people that have ever existed. A broken family, Dad wasn't there, Mom didn't care, abuse, neglect. All stories told often by murderers and serial killers alike. Unfortunately, James's upbringing was no exception to this unwritten rule. Dad goes to work to provide the paycheck, comes home and drinks until he passes out. Mom cleans, cooks, and takes care of household affairs. The typical family of that era. In this case, though, Mom gives no love to the younger boy either. And it would wear on James, day in, day out. Leonard Sr. wasn't particularly successful in life, yet his presence was dominant. He was violent and always showed a preference for Leonard Jr. He made sure that little Jimmy knew that there was no pride to be had in the young boy. There was no encouragement or guidance from this man at all, only shame and a void of confidence that James would ever amount to anything. Perhaps he was right, but a little bit of encouragement from a parent to a child can go a very long way in helping build self-esteem. Maybe Jimmy would have turned out differently if he had only been shown a little bit of love from his parents. Throughout his childhood, Jimmy, as he would be called by those around him, was always one of the smaller kids. Hell, as an adult, Jimmy stood 5 feet, 6 inches tall, depending on his shoes, and weighed in at a paltry 135 pounds, or a little over 60 and a half kilos for those of you who speak metric. I've also seen it reported that he stood 5 foot 4 inches or 5 foot 5 inches, so I'm not 100% sure on this, but either way, he would be well below average size. Simply taking a look at photos of him being escorted by police will give you an idea of his short stature. I'll post a pic or two on the Facebook page. His childhood height was certainly much less pronounced, and I'd wager that it goes without saying he would have been considered a runt by any stretch of the imagination. He was never athletic or in any sense noteworthy to any of his classmates in school growing up. Jimmy was a smart kid, and as far as that went in the middle of the 20th century, probably called a nerd by the jocks and cool kids. In today's society, being a nerd isn't necessarily seen as a flaw in character, but in the 40s and 50s, a nerd would have been picked on relentlessly by the kids who were handsome, outgoing, good at sports, sociable. All traits that Jimmy didn't possess. Leonard never showed love, compassion, or any kind emotion toward either of his sons. Never went out to play catch, didn't take them fishing, or teach them how a man should provide for his family, as many respectable fathers would in that era. Leonard Sr. was not a respectable father. July 29, 1946. Leonard Sr. dies unexpectedly at the young age of just 37 from tuberculosis-related issues when Leonard Jr. was 14 and James was 12 years of age. I've been unable to find any reports on the exact details of the complications he suffered, but according to the Mayo Clinic, TB can permanently damage the kidneys, liver, and heart, so I think it's safe to assume he suffered one of these issues, at least. After Leonard Sr. passed, the traditional role of man of the house now falls on one of his sons, and it's a role that Leonard Jr. embraces. Like father, like son, they say. So Leonard Jr. picks up where his dad left off and continues the abuse on young Jimmy. I'm sure old dad would be proud. Jimmy told psychiatrists that his brother would pick on him often, tying him up, lashing him with a water hose, locking him in the closet, or pinning him down and sitting on his head. It didn't help his case that Jimmy was an unhealthy child, sickly and weak. Easy pickings for bullies, and he got that not only from his brother, but from other kids as well. He was meek in stature and suffered from asthma, and his demeanor was timid. He wasn't allowed to participate in phys ed in school and couldn't join in sports due to a medical order. The deck was stacked against little Jimmy, and despite the events that would take place later, I still can't help but feel for this poor kid on some level. He never stood a chance from the very beginning. I can relate to him. Though I wasn't sickly or limited by physical ailments, I too was an introvert, preferring to spend a lot of time in solitude, left to my own thoughts while diving into a video game or book. There's nothing wrong with that, and over the years I've learned how to open up around others and socialize, but I'll tell you, it's very draining and I usually have to recharge afterwards. I'm sure Jimmy and I share that trait, but unfortunately I don't think Jimmy was ever able to fight off his bullies and overcome his own mind, and we'll see the results of all of those bad times soon enough. He never went out to hang out with friends, partly because there were few, and partly because he probably just didn't want to, which I understand. A neighbor would go on to say that according to Mother Charity, quote, "They were never allowed to be children. They were always men of the house because their father died at an early age. They were very responsible." Leonard Jr. and Jimmy were polar opposites. Junior was a good athlete, strong, tall, and handsome. He was a good student, and some of James's teachers who also had Junior as a student would remind him of how well Junior had performed in class. Though Jimmy was an intelligent child, he never applied himself or realized his full potential, and his teachers made sure to humiliate his performance. What effect would this have on a child? I can only imagine the feeling of inadequacy young Jamie must have felt hearing this from people who are essentially strangers but play a pivotal role in growing up. We all remember our favorite teachers in school, and we all remember our least favorite. I don't think Jamie ever had what we could consider a favorite. He lived in the shadow of his big brother. Their mother, Charity, was proud of Leonard Jr. and showed her love and affection, often while expressing shame, disapproval, and contempt for young Jamie, as stated before. The constant reminders that he was never wanted, at least not as a boy, would wear on Jamie day in, day out. Reportedly, Jamie battled with thoughts of suicide throughout his life, and at 16 years old, Jamie decided that enough was enough, so he ran away from home and attempted suicide by hanging himself with a bedsheet. Much like the story of his life up to that point, he failed. Perhaps, and I know this may sound dark and a bit harsh, but the world would have been better off had he succeeded. There would certainly have been 11 people who would live to potentially die a natural death, who could have gone on to do great things with their time on Earth, raise families, contribute wonderful ideas for the good of mankind, invent the cure for cancer, who knows? Every life that is forcibly removed from existence could possibly send the world on a different trajectory. Maybe by now we could have had free energy or a vaccine for AIDS. Perhaps one of the Rupert kids would have gone on to be president and world history would be different. It's an interesting thought that often goes through my head when I think of the victims of horrible crimes. How could the fate of the world have changed had this person been able to live their life to a natural end? It's a profound thought. Nearing adulthood, Jamie managed to start up a relationship with Alma Algier, which would be one of his only known girlfriends throughout his life. I wasn't able to find any information as to why the relationship fell apart, but to add salt to the wound of their breakup, Leonard Jr. would come to date and eventually marry Alma, subsequently having 8 children with her. This was a major straw that would be added to the weight that Jamie was carrying on his back, and a strong point of contention he held against his brother. After high school, Leonard Jr. earned a degree in electrical engineering while Jamie flunked out of college altogether. Leonard went on to secure a good job as an engineer with General Electric and planted the seeds of his future, which ultimately sprouted into home ownership, a stable marriage with Alma, a successful career at a good company, and 8 children that would come along over the years, 5 boys, 4 girls, most of which were about a year or two older than the child that followed, except for the youngest, John, who was 5 years younger than his sister, Teresa. By all accounts, they were a well-functioning family. They had a stable father who was loving and provided well, a loving mother who was a strong grounding force and kept household affairs in tip-top order. These kids had a bright future and a good foundation for success in life. Unfortunately for these young ones, it would be cut short in the blink of an eye by someone they should have been able to trust. Jamie had been unable to hold steady employment, moving from job to job over the years. As time wore on, he developed a substantial drinking habit, frequenting a local bar, the 19th Hole Cocktail Lounge, which eventually became a daily hangout for him. Neighbors recounted seeing him leave every afternoon and not return until the wee hours of the morning, pretty much every day. Somehow, though his financial situation was unstable at best, James had taken an interest in guns and became a bit of a collector. He would take his guns out to the banks of the Great Miami River and shoot at cans, honing his aim and control of each of his prized firearms. Jamie had finally found something he was good at. Witnesses reported seeing him shooting cans while walking along the banks as they tumbled from each shot. He would also go to the local target range and get some practice in a controlled environment from time to time. I'm uncertain how long he had this hobby, but what I am sure of is that it must have felt good to Jamie. This was something he excelled in, and he enjoyed it greatly. Guns appear to have a subconscious effect on those who own them. They can turn a timid, quiet pushover into someone who isn't afraid of conflict, sometimes even flipping the switch that allows their inner aggressions to spill out into the real world. Jimmy had always avoided confrontations, but at some point after his fascination with guns led to ownership, he found the guts to open up. It was no coincidence that in 1965, police learned that Jimmy was responsible for, quote, an obscene phone call made to the local public library of which he was a regular visitor. This was out of character for Jimmy, as he was known as a quiet, respectful man who minded his own business. Upon admitting responsibility, Jimmy stated to police that he thought his phone, not only at home, but in other places he frequented, such as the 19th Hole Cocktail Lounge, had been wiretapped by the FBI, and he believed they also bugged his car to track his movements. Perhaps this was his way of testing his theory. This is the only reported run-in with the law Jimmy would experience in his entire life, at least until Easter 1975. In retrospect, there are some worrying themes developing in Jimmy's life during this time. I've been fascinated with true crime stories since I was a kid, and I have to tell you, this would be a big red flag to me if I were alive and knew of this at the time. Paranoia and guns simply do not mix. We'll definitely see more of those conflicting ingredients in future episodes of this podcast. At this time, he was a fairly skilled draftsman, which is, according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, a person whose job is to make drawings that will be used to make machines, buildings, etc. The foreman of the company that employed him in this role would go on to state that he was well performing. My understanding of why Jimmy lost this job is simply due to widespread layoffs. March 29th, 1975, Jimmy's birthday. Jimmy turned 41 on this day, and as usual, he celebrated by going to his favorite local tavern, the 19th Hole Cocktail Lounge. As previously stated, he was a regular patron and had actually befriended a waitress by the name of Wanda Brown. On this particular night, Jimmy drank for a while and, in an exchange with Wanda, said that he had a problem that he needed to take care of and expressed frustration with his mother, who had threatened to evict him from her home due partly to his inability to hold employment, his alcoholism, and the weight of monetary debt which he owed her. Both Charity and Leonard had loaned Jimmy money at various times, and these were debts that he had yet to make good on. He left the bar for a short while, then returned. And when Wanda asked him if he had taken care of his problem, Jimmy responded simply saying, "Not yet." This was potentially a hint at what would come soon, but how could she have guessed what Jimmy meant? To her, Jimmy was a regular Joe who came in to have some drinks on a nightly basis. They were well acquainted, and she had never known of any inner demons that Jimmy might have battled aside from his alcoholism. Would she have ever expected to see Jimmy on the news in relation to what would be the worst instance of familicide in the history of the United States up to that point? Jimmy stayed at the bar until closing time, 2:30 a.m., then made his way home to the comfort of his bed. March 30th, 1975, Easter Sunday. This is a day revered by Christians the world over as the day Jesus rose from his tomb and ascended to heaven. I'm not sure of the traditions around the world, but in the U.S., it's a day where families come together, often from great distances, to enjoy each other's company. It isn't unlike Thanksgiving, which is to celebrate the harvest of the season. There's usually a nice meal prepared while the little ones hunt for brightly colored eggs and other small treats hidden around the home, park, or wherever the family gathers. Each child gets a basket to store their collected treasures in during the hunt to be inventoried and eaten later. Along with eggs, a young girl or boy could find chocolates, lollipops, and other various sweets. I've personally found a $10 bill hidden inside of one of the plastic snap-together eggs when I was little. These are the memories that stay with you as you grow up, and passing this tradition down to your own children brings back the nostalgic joy of it all. This was, however, in the small city of Hamilton, Ohio, not going to be a day of fond memories. Easter started much like any other holiday. Neighbor John Spear, who lived across the street, sent his 8-year-old daughter to the Rupert house that morning. Grandma Charity told the little girl that her grandchildren would be there later for dinner. After attending Mass, Leonard and Alma gathered the kids up in their family van, and as a lot of families would in those days and still do, they made their way to Grandma's house to indulge in the wonderful meal she would cook, surrounded by loved ones. On this day, the family gathers as one to talk of good times, past times, and to tell the story of their current lives and share their hopes for the future over a great meal, with the small ones bouncing around, buzzed from consuming too much chocolate and other candies, left in clever hiding spots by the Easter Bunny. These are indeed the best of times to a small child. Neighbors reported seeing the Rupert children in the yard around the home, laughing, playing, and hunting those little treasures left by a mysterious, well-wishing giant rabbit. They would say how they thought of the Rupert family as average, quiet, friendly, not in the least a standout in the neighborhood. Jimmy was known among those who lived close by as a nice man. He kept to himself, took care of his responsibilities, and was generally known as unremarkable. To his neighbors, Jimmy would certainly not be the kind of man capable of portraying the boogeyman in a horror movie. Still, to this day, his feeble appearance belies the actions that he's capable of. The boogeyman doesn't always slink in shadows or stalk from afar. All too often, he stands right in front of you, and you never expect him to transform into a villain from your worst nightmares. Late afternoon. According to Jimmy, it was around 4 p.m. when he arose from bed. All of Leonard and Alma's children were in the living room, tallying their treats, playing and munching away, while Charity was making sloppy joes for the troop. Leonard Jr. was sitting at the kitchen table having a smoke and reading the newspaper. Alma was seated across the table making small talk with Charity. James emerges from his bedroom and comes downstairs groggy and hungover. He and Leonard strike up a brief conversation about the state of the stock market. The only details of the events of this day are those given by James to psychiatrists. There are no conflicting witness statements as to what would happen. The order of events has been reported in several sequences, but the gist of it is as follows. At some point during James and Leonard's conversation, Leonard would ask James, "How's the Volkswagen?" For a number of months prior, James had nagging problems with his car and had come to the conclusion that Leonard was somehow sabotaging and causing the trouble he had been having. According to James, this was a loaded question and, in his mind, a confirmation that Leonard had to be the main source of his problems. It was a problem that could easily be solved, so according to James, he didn't answer the question directly, instead stating that he was heading down to the local target range for some shooting practice. He goes upstairs to get his guns and ammo. After retrieving his .357 Magnum, two .22 caliber pistols, and what is described as an 18-shot rifle, caliber unknown, he came back downstairs. He swung the rifle off his shoulder and propped it up against the refrigerator, pulled a .22 caliber pistol, positioned himself with the kitchen sink at his back, took direct aim at Leonard and opened fire, standing only a couple feet away. He took aim next at Alma and pulled the trigger. Charity, realizing what was happening, charged at James in a futile attempt and was shot, while nephew David and niece Teresa rushed into the kitchen to see what was happening, only to be shot as they made a break for the door. There was evidence that David and Teresa had almost made it through the back door, but were gunned down before they got out. Systematically, James went through the rest of the house, shooting each of the six remaining Rupert children, as some of them ate candy. At some point, he later told psychiatrists, he sat down on the couch and casually took shots at the last four children. The shooting happened so fast, I'm sure even the older kids were shot before they even realized what was taking place. According to James, he had shot each family member at least one time, some twice, to incapacitate them. Then he would reload his gun and go back through the scene, delivering a final shot to the head of each victim except Alma to make sure the job was finished. In an interview, Butler County Coroner Garrett Boone would say, "It's unlikely that 11 people would have been shot and killed unless they were held in some way or were in a position where none of them could escape." It goes without saying that this must have been terrifying. It's haunting to imagine what the victims must have been thinking in the last few moments of their short lives. These young children were doing what most kids would be doing on this holiday with loved ones. How could anyone turn a gun on their own family, especially children, and pull the trigger? I've struggled with this question throughout my research for this episode, and I simply can't fathom how anyone could commit such a cold act. To say I'm at a loss for words is a gross understatement. In total, 31 shots were fired, and within a span of 5 minutes or less, 11 members of the Rupert family, 8 of them ranging from 4 to 17 years old, would be dead at the hands of a small, timid, cowardly failure of a man. There were no reports of gunfire from the neighbors around the Rupert house that day. In later interviews, nearby residents would say they heard or saw nothing unusual, just the Rupert children outside hunting Easter eggs earlier that afternoon. Certainly no gunshots or indication that anything was amiss. Hours later, police would descend on the home after James placed a 911 call in which he informed the dispatcher, "There's been a shooting." Police arrived shortly after the call and found James waiting just inside the door. As they approached, they saw two bodies behind him in the living room. Upon entry, they found more bodies, and when all is said and done, the officers and other personnel who would enter that house would see the aftermath of this horrible shooting firsthand. The blood that had drained from the 11 bodies covered the floors, soaked the carpets, and even dripped through the floorboards and into the basement. I have no doubt that the scene was forever burned into their memory. To this day, 44 years later, this massacre is still the worst case of familicide committed in a single private residence. The bloodstains remain on the floorboards and support beams in the basement to this very day. Prosecutor John Holcomb would go on to say, "When I walked through that front door right into the middle of all that carnage, I saw that little four-year-old boy with blue bib corduroy overalls on, a long-sleeve blue cotton shirt, and lying on the floor at the foot of the couch, stretched out with a bullet hole in his head. In his outstretched right hand, he had partially opened the tinfoil wrapper off a chocolate Easter egg. This was a sight that shook me to the depths of my soul, and I have never forgotten it." James would offer very little information to the officers, and the only quote I've been able to find from the initial questioning by the police who were on the scene, James explained, "My mother drove me crazy by always combing my hair, talked to me like I was a baby, and tried to make me into a homosexual. Hardly worth being murdered over, and hardly a reason to kill your entire family." James was arrested and booked into the Butler County Jail, and his bond was set at $200,000, which is roughly equivalent to about $900,000 today. On April 8, 1975, Rupert pled not guilty by reason of insanity in a court hearing. A mental health evaluation was ordered for a period of 30 days, and a second hearing was held on May 13th the following month, in which Rupert was deemed sane and fit to stand trial. James's attorneys would continue to pursue an insanity defense, however. I mean, someone who would commit this kind of atrocity must be crazy, right? The judge declared a mistrial under the premise of James being unable to get a fair trial in Hamilton, and a new trial was ordered to take place in Findlay, Ohio, a short trip south of Toledo. The new trial began, and Prosecutor Holcomb would make a compelling case for the motive behind the massacre. You see, James's mother Charity and Leonard held savings accounts, life insurance, investments, and properties. The value of the estate James would stand to inherit upon their death was about $300,000, which, adjusted for inflation in 2019, would be a bit over $1.4 million. Prosecutor Holcomb stated at the opening of the trial that the killings were, quote, part of a master plan with the end in view he would be sent to Lima, a state mental institution, where he would eventually be declared sane and then walk out with $300,000 in his pocket. If found guilty of murder, the inheritance would be forfeit. But if he was declared not guilty by reason of insanity, all of this wealth would go directly to him, and all of his financial woes would be over once released from the hospital. He could invest, rack up interest in savings accounts, and trade stocks. He wouldn't need to worry about employment anymore. The three-judge panel would ruin his plans, though, and decided 2-1 in favor of guilt on all 11 counts of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life imprisonment for each charge. Not so fast. A few years later, his defense attorney, who remained a staunch ally, filed an appeal revealing that there had been a misunderstanding with his client. James thought that the three-judge panel would have to come to a unanimous decision in order to secure a conviction. Yet again, a new trial was ordered, and again, James would opt for a trial via three-judge panel. James's attorney hired psychiatrists using his own money, and with their help, James would subsequently be convicted only of the murders of Charity and Leonard Jr. For the murders of Alma and her 8 children, he would be found not guilty by reason of insanity. In reality, though, this didn't change James's situation at all. On July 23, 1982, he was handed down 2 life sentences to be served at the Allen Correctional Institution in Lima, Ohio. James would not inherit the estate of the family he murdered. At the time of this recording, James is still incarcerated and is 85 years old. That is it for episode 1. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed putting it together and re-recording it. If you did like it, please find it on Facebook, leave a thumbs up, and maybe even join the group. All you gotta do is search Worse Than Fiction Podcast, or maybe even just Worse Than Fiction, I don't know. But either way, I'll put some links in the notes of this episode. If you have a suggestion for an interesting case or event, even a natural disaster, head to worsethanfictionpodcast.com or find me on Facebook or Twitter, wherever. I'm everywhere. Leave me a suggestion. All options are on the table at this point. Hell, even if I don't do it, I still like the suggestions. So, you know, bring them on. And as well as any feedback you might have. Until you hear from me again, goodbye.